Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. We're sitting here in beautiful Butte, Montana, across the street from the courthouse. And I was just noticing that somebody has polished the copper doors, and they look pretty spiffy. Hi, we have a very interesting guest this evening. Her name is Dawn McGee, and she is the CEO of Good Works Evergreen. And in just a moment or two, Dawn will be here and tell you all about wonderful things that she's up to. And also remember that you can email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. This is Heartstock. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Heartstock. I'm Carol Murphy, your host, and our guest this evening is Dawn McGee. She's the CEO of Good Works Evergreen. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, Carol. Thanks so much for having me on your program this afternoon.
Thanks for being our guest. Please give our listeners a little intro as to what you do at Good Works Evergreen.
Sure. Good Works Evergreen is one of many companies we have in our portfolio. We have the High Stakes Foundation, where we grant and make about $1 million a year across the state into various social enterprises, including social justice, organizations that are working on climate change, sustainable agricultural programs, and the like. And we do that and have done that for the last 11 years. I'm also the CEO of Good Works Ventures, which was our first investment initiative we started off with, where we worked across the state with other people to form essentially an entrepreneurial economy. So we would stop exporting the best and brightest of our kids to go find a job someplace else, because there weren't that many jobs 12 years ago in Montana. And I think we've done a pretty bang up job with that. We now have about a $1 billion tech economy across the state. And if you want to stay here and get a job, you can. So we then turned our attention to the next place where jobs were being lost at an incredible rate. I read in the newspaper about 2 years ago that there was a gentleman who manufactured high-end tarps for trucks and boats in Stevensville. And he died without a succession plan in place. And overnight, 10 jobs in Stevensville were lost. And my team and I said, wow, that's going to start happening everywhere, because there's so many aging baby boomers whose kids are either off some other place like Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Portland or the like, or they don't want to own dad's business. But these businesses are sort of core to our rural communities. And when you lose 10 jobs in a rural community that's small, that impacts all the rest of the businesses in that community, and it can kind of have a downward spiral. So we decided to take some of our own assets, starting 2 years ago, to start purchasing these businesses, transitioning them to new leadership, and really empowering the businesses and the employees.
This is an awesome idea, and I'm thinking that all over the country, this is happening in places like Montana. Is this true?
Absolutely. It's happening all over the country. I think that the urban areas are perhaps less affected by the lack of transition strategy, because more kids stay home on the coast, for one, and they have other solutions. And it is still happening even in those places. I think particularly for our small manufacturing operations, like who would have thought that tarps were being manufactured in Stevensville? If we don't do something to sort of stem the tide of these closures or transition these businesses, we're going to really bump up against the loss of even more manufacturing in the United States.
So right before we went on the air, we were talking about the fact that you actually used to be a DJ and you were in radio before. Tell us a little bit about what brought you to Montana and what you did before that.
Sure. I have had a sort of circuitous journey to Montana, which I firmly consider home at this point. But for the longest amount of time, I don't think I'd lived anywhere more than about 2.5 years. I was born into a military family and went to 21 places before I went to college. Went to college at the University of North Carolina and left there the day I graduated for New York City to find my fortune, as it were. And I spent a number of years in New York training as a lawyer, practicing law there. And through a variety of circumstances mid-career, I wound up going to Switzerland, of all places, to become the general counsel for a small private Swiss bank. And while I was there, I was sort of watching money move around the globe. And I thought to myself, wow, trust indenture agreements are a little bit boring. And this money thing, it seems like it's what's really driving change. And I think one of my motivating factors for going to law school was I was always keenly interested in social justice and making places better and creating livelihoods for people who needed them. And I figured out pretty quickly when I was in Switzerland that the money was what was making a lot of things happen for good or for ill. And when I returned to the United States, I decided I wanted to work in social investment. And at the time, those opportunities were extremely limited. But I was lucky enough to essentially co-found a social impact fund called Global Partners with John Harrington. And we had invested during the late 90s, right, sort of during the tech boom, the earliest tech booms where everyone was investing in monetizing eyeballs. And I didn't understand a thing about how that worked. So we invested in things like solar energy in Guatemala and Honduras and organic olive oil and things that made sense to me. And as a result of that, when the first tech bust happened, our portfolio wound up performing very, very well because we actually had real companies that did real things and they didn't blow up at that time like many others did. So that kind of set me on the right path to use other people's money for social change. And from that, I went on to raise and implement a couple of additional funds. And I was working in Seattle doing microfinance work worldwide prior to my arrival in Montana. And I came to work for a person named Mary Stranahan, who some people in our community know as a really generous donor. She was an inheritor of wealth from Champion Spark Plugs. And she decided when she retired from the practice of medicine on the Salish Kootenai Reservation that she wanted to really sort of get strategic about how she was putting her money to work during her lifetime to create the kind of changes she wanted to see in Montana. And she asked me to come be her partner in doing that. And I have been here for 12 years. Couldn't be happier.
And Montana was very lucky to get you.
I think it's like they said, life, love at first sight on both parts.
Who got who, right?
Yeah.
So give us a little history of Good Works Venture and specifically Good Works Evergreen, because it sounds like Evergreen is your latest. Is that correct?
Yes. So the history of ventures first, or should we start with Evergreen as the last?
Yeah, just the evolution from one to the next, maybe.
Yes. So we started ventures with the idea that a lot of problems, homelessness, hunger, justice issues get created often because of economic issues. And as we looked around the state of Montana 12 years ago, the opportunity for people coming out of the university or who just wanted work in our communities was pretty sparse. And people were often working 2 and 3 jobs as coffee shop people or behind the grocery store register, just trying to patch a life together here. Because as our extraction industries and our timber industries wound down, there were really no jobs replacing those jobs that were lost. So we just thought, well, how about we just start investing in people with bright ideas that are going to do good things and hopefully employ people. And to that end, we and a group of other people worked across the state to educate people and to make it safe and to normalize what entrepreneurship looks like. most people, when they look around, they look up at who their parents were and what they did. And if they don't see an entrepreneur in the family, thinking about becoming an entrepreneur is an extremely risky or scary thought. So we just tried to provide a lot of education, everything from inviting lawyers to give brown bag lunches on intellectual property and how to form a company, to having marketing people come and talk about how do you find a market for your product, and just engaging in these exercises as a community across the state, getting John Tester and the Blackstone Company to start the launch pads at our universities. And I think together through a lot of people's work, we were able to write some very early checks into companies that now employ in excess of 100 people. For example, we're investors in Submittable. We were early investors in Thomas. We're investors in the Audience Awards. We have 35 companies in our portfolio, and a lot of them have employed a lot of people over the years.
And what does that portfolio primarily consist of, would you say? Because I found it really interesting that you didn't invest in tech early on. So when the bust happened, you were sitting pretty. Is that true still? Or is it sounds like there's a lot of tech in there too.
No, there's definitely a lot of tech. We're very tech heavy in the GoodWorks portfolio. The portfolio I was talking about earlier where there's no tech was the first one where I was just a little baby investor and had no idea what I was doing. I think technology is one of the places that it's possible to create jobs in a place like Montana. It's often difficult to create manufacturing operations and other sort of industry heavy specifics because it's hard to fly out of here. It's expensive to send your sales team on the road. It's difficult to ship out of here. It's very expensive unless you're doing backhaul shipping to have your goods and services leave Montana. So technology is one of those things where we can say, hey, we've got tremendous assets here. We've got incredibly educated kids. We've got a wonderful place to live. You can come develop your company here. And because of the power of the internet, like you can run a business very, very well from this place and you can have a quality of life and you can raise your kids in a place that they're probably going to thrive. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty tech heavy in our companies. Not all of them are technology related, but the bulk of them are.
So we're right at that halfway point. So we're going to take a quick music break in just a moment. We'll be right back. Don McGee of GoodWorks Evergreen. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. And this evening, we have Don McGee with us of GoodWorks Evergreen. Hi again, Don.
Hi there.
So I'm just thinking there might be someone out there listening that really needs what you do. Walk us through the process. How do you find businesses and all of that good jazz?
Sure. Well, we are just beginning this enterprise. We've purchased two businesses so far, and we have a term sheet out on the third, which we hope to close in January. Ultimately, we'd like to acquire hundreds of businesses and put them into sort of a bucket. And our idea is that if we create a good enough portfolio bucket of businesses, that eventually we can transition ownership from us to broad-based community ownership, which is what I'm really interested in. These companies have generally been in existence for 20 or 30 years, and they're profitable, and they have the ability to pay a very reasonable dividend. And I think a lot of people would be very interested in investing in companies in Montana and owning that as a portion of their portfolio and their retirement assets.
Is there a cooperative portion or aspect of this where workers also can own the companies?
There will be. What I would say is this: most people are not really interested in owning an illiquid asset where there's no ability to get in or out. It's not particularly meaningful. And most employees generally tell us, just pay us more. For example, when we bought Don's Hardware store in Hamilton a year and a half ago, we raised the average wage from about $11 an hour to $16 an hour. We provided health insurance to people for the first time ever, and we're very actively working on getting a 401k in place for the 2020 year. And people really right now need wages, need take-home pay, really want to have that as opposed to ownership. They'd rather be bonused out if they performed well. Ultimately, though, when we have the ability to have broad-based community ownership, I certainly hope that all of our employees will participate in what they've created, because it's for them, about them, and by them. I'm just sort of trying to help shepherd and birth a new process along where these jobs stay in our communities and our communities can continue to thrive as a result of that.
Well, and it seems to me that if the employees do have a stake in the company, it almost increases the chance that that company will continue to be a success and even become a bigger success. Do you think that that's true?
Again, I think it can be true. It's really complicated if you have no way for them to exit their stake in the company. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not meaningful unless you're actually paying dividends at that point. But I do believe that at some point in the future, when we're able to have unaccredited investors and to be able to do the education with our employees about what it actually means to own a stake in the company, for sure. I'm definitely wanting to head our boat there. In the meantime, we are really focused on making sure they're well taken care of while they're in our employ and to drive the businesses forward so that we can get a large enough bucket that we can get to that community ownership piece.
So you mentioned earlier that you have two companies right now in the portfolio. Can you kind of maybe tell us a little bit about the other company and what other types of companies are you looking for?
Sure. I think it's emblematic of our first company that we closed on Don's 80th birthday. That was his birthday present to him. And his kids work for the business. They did not want to buy the business because two reasons. One, they're getting close to retirement age themselves. And two, they said that if they bought the business, their dad would never retire. And they wanted him to be able to do that. So his kids continue to work for us to this day. And I think we're doing great at that first business. Like I said, we've raised wages, reinvested in capital investments in the company, and are really making it a much nicer place than we found it. The second business is called Tripp Lumber, and I'm not quite sure how old Dave Tripp is. He still works for us at this moment in time, although he's going to go off on his retirement journey towards the end of this year. But I think he'll still continue to work with us in some capacity going forward. And his son Dylan has recently joined our team as a salesperson. So it's not that we're trying to disincentivize family participation. It's just transitioning to the next leadership that's actually going to run the show on a day-to-day basis, may or may not be the kids of original founders. What we're looking for, businesses that employ five or more people that are profitable as they stand today. Like, we're not looking for turnaround situations where the businesses aren't making money or quasi-making money. We're looking for the good, solid businesses that are part of communities. And aside from that, we're fairly agnostic, with the exception of the fact of not wanting to move into restaurants, bars, and anything to do with extraction economy.
Very interesting. And once you approach the business or the business approaches you, what happens from that point forward?
Well, we, you know, see whether there's a good fit from a compatibility perspective. We try to do a detailed financial analysis of, is this a company that we feel like we could shepherd into the future? We also sort of look for businesses that are, to the extent possible, Walmart and Amazon proof. As you know, those businesses have upended a lot of the small businesses in our community. So we're looking for businesses where you might actually need to go down to the hardware store with your screw you're trying to find a copy of and say, I need one of these, or how do I do this? Or in the example of Tripp Lumber, which is a remanufacturing facility where we do value added to board planks, like creating flooring or siding or that sort of thing. Pretty hard to ship that from Amazon.
True. Yes. So looking at that, this was like one of my very first questions when I was thinking about this. And you were mentioning all the positive inroads that you've made with the companies that you purchased. Is there an analysis process that you go through that helps you decide, you know, we need to leave this just like it is, as opposed to there are some improvements and changes to make?
Yeah, I mean, most of these businesses, they're, you know, they've been great businesses over time, but as founders get older, they tend to either scale down, not continue to make capital improvements in the businesses because they're thinking about retirement and they're not sure what's going to happen. And other ones which are going to require much less of a touch. So it really depends at the stage which the business is, to the extent that we can value add by perhaps making purchase of a new machine which can do something that hasn't been done before, or to upgrade mechanical equipment and the like. We're certainly planning on doing that. Facilities improvement for just about everybody is always on the list. But there's some businesses which we've looked at, and in fact, the one we're planning on closing in the spring or January of this year, they're pretty intact. And I don't know, except for finding the right next leadership, really what there is to change there. It's an ongoing operation in a small community that's valued by the community and valued by the owners, but they're just quite frankly ready to retire and they would like to transition their business into the hands of somebody who can keep it running.
Hmm. So let's pretend you have a magic wand in your hand. You talked a little bit about what you'd like to create moving forward. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, what are you envisioning? This could be, you know, beyond the borders of Montana. What are your plans?
Exactly. What kind of empire are we building anyway? So I will say this. People ask, like, well, why are you guys doing this? Why don't people just buy these businesses? And there's a couple reasons. One, if you're just a solo person who says, wow, I'd really like to take over Don's hardware store, it's unlikely the bank is going to loan you enough money to make that worthwhile to Don or to anyone else. So because the banks can't really lend on these things without enough assets backing their loans because of federal regulations, what's the next step? The next step is, well, maybe private equity could come and, you know, invest in these things, but they're way too small for most private equity firms. So there's just a huge gap in terms of who can buy these businesses and what's going to happen to them. And we're just really interested in trying to save as many of these starfish as we possibly can put in our bucket before founders transition. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a 10 to 15 year window to do this in Montana. And although there's plenty of opportunity in plenty of other states, I would say our focus has always been on Montana. And I'm not going to say I would never like go slightly over the border to Salmon or to someplace that's really close like Jackson. But I doubt that I'm going to be doing anything in South Carolina, for example.
And why only 10 to 15 years? Are laws changing?
No, you've got really aging founders. And to the extent that those businesses disappear, they're gone forever.
Mm-hmm. And as far as public investment, you know, do you see the townspeople investing in these companies too? You mentioned that before. How would that actually happen?
Well, you know, we have just about exhausted the use of our own funds. So we are going to have to go out and raise more money to continue to pursue this dream and this endeavor. My hope is that like major public institutions like the Cole Trust and other people, and certainly the state government has a very vested interest in keeping these businesses open and these taxpayers paying taxes. So we're hopeful that municipalities, the state, the Cole Trust Fund, when we go to raise money, will open their doors and talk to us because we think we have a really good product and we're serving, you know, the entire state and our communities in terms of keeping these businesses in place, doing what they need to be doing.
Mm-hmm. In the other ventures that you have going on currently, is this all like a big juggling act or do you see more of your eggs going into this basket in the future?
So we're not actively writing checks out of the GoodWorks Ventures portfolio anymore. We're doing some follow-on investments. For example, we just made a follow-on investment in AdvicePay, which is one of our companies in Bozeman. So we're not as active on that side anymore. We really are focusing our efforts on our foundation grant making across the state and on working evergreen.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the grant making, we've only got about a minute left, but maybe when you tell everybody how they might reach you, you could put in a little piece about that too, how folks might pursue grant opportunities.
Sure. So we have a welcome open page on highstakesfoundation.org. highstakesfoundation.org, and there's a how to apply page right there. GW Evergreen is the Evergreen site, gwevergreen.com, and then goodworksventures.com is our other one.
Fantastic.
And we'd be happy to have a conversation with anybody who would like to have a conversation with us about just about anything.
This is Heartstock Radio, and we've been speaking with Don McGee of Good Works Ventures and Good Works Evergreen. Thanks so much, and we will see you next week. Peace.
On the sign it said, no trespass.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at ButteAmericaRadio.org.